Sit down and buckle up. It's time for the Pirate Monk Podcast.
Welcome to another episode of the Pirate Monk Podcast. Hey, once again, I'm Nate Larkin, here with my friend and yours, Sharon Porter. We got a great guest lined up. He'll be here along shortly. We are recording this episode in February of 2024, shortly before the High Holy Days, the High Holy Day of all women. I that's probably a sexist thing to say.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I would, we'll leave it just so we can remember to learn to be sensitive.
It's Valentine's Day.
I thought you were talking about Resurrection Sunday coming up. I'm like, it's not that soon. Oh, no, you're talking about Valentine's Day.
Here's what I recall from the early days of Samson, when us actually having conversations where we're because for a lot of guys, Valentine's Day is not even on our calendar. We didn't even see it coming. We just don't give it a thought. And so we started reminding each other fairly early, hey, this is coming up and this is going to be an important date. We actually had consultations, plans. We did, figured out what we were going to do for these women. We were trying to show that we actually love and care for.
Yeah. I used to have a group that we would put out challenges and try to make it a little more macho. Like, we're going to beat the other guys at doing better, being, yeah, it's, you know, it's nothing like adding machismo to something that's supposed to be like heartfelt and sensitive. But yeah, yeah. I think it got our fuel out that way. And so that way we had nothing but the sensitive shit left for the other.
Yeah.
So it was good.
Well, I haven't had anybody doing that for me this year. So we're recording this the day before Valentine's Day, and I'm behind the ball. I got to figure something out here.
Now, does Allie have high expectations or low expectations of Valentine's Day?
She has low expectations, at least as far as what she communicates to me. She seems to greatly appreciate the gestures I make. And I think every woman likes to be wooed. I'm not the most romantic man in the world. I gotta work at it.
See, now, I feel like the version of younger you was all about the romance.
Yeah, yeah.
Were you not, like, in your 20s when you would think about the wooing process?
Yeah, until I'd actually accomplished the conquest, until I had her. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, come on, that's the preach it on that. What's wrong with us? Now that I got the thing I felt was worth wooing, now I'm like, all right, I'm bored with that.
Yeah, right. So
we're going to be talking about the human condition today. I feel like that's right in there somewhere as a really disappointing part of the human condition.
But Allie and I are down in Amelia Island, Florida, down here for 6 weeks, as regular listeners will know. I just came back from a 2-day trip down to Melbourne Satellite Beach, hung with some brothers there, and then I had dinner on Super Bowl Sunday.
Did you watch the Super Bowl?
I caught the second half when I got back to the hotel. Yeah. Did you watch the Super Bowl?
Yeah, it was kind of emotionally hard for me. I realized that I do not hang out with people in person very much. So I greatly look forward to my once a month dinners at church. I love Sunday morning so I can see people. I'm around my kids all the time, but not adults. And Super Bowl is the one sporting event a year that either have people over here or go to their house. And so I was so looking forward to it. And then all the plans fell through.
Oh, no.
Made all the Super Bowl foods, and two of my kids were working, and the other three left after about 15 minutes, and I sat alone in the living room watching it with a big bowl of bean dip and a bunch of jalapeno poppers I made.
Oh, and that's heartbreaking, Aaron. I'm sorry.
Oh, I had to mind my mind, because I was going to some bitter places.
Sure.
But then it was a really good game, and one of my kids came back down by the end, and we watched the end. And so I thought the game was great. It was disappointing as an event.
Yeah, yeah. I really wanted to see the underdogs pull it out. I wanted to see Brock Purdy, the guy, Mr. Irrelevant, the guy selected dead last in the NFL draft to lead his team to the championship. See,
this is also a reason I need to be with people, because I know nothing about these teams, and so I'm missing out all those tidbits that would have made me pick a team to root for.
Yeah.
So I mostly could only pick teams based on all my friends in Kansas City that I wanted to be texting and making fun of them, because that's half the fun of the Super Bowl for me, is highlighting plays where their team did something wrong.
Talking trash, yeah.
Talking trash to people who care.
And I had a great time last night in Lakeland, Florida. Guys from a few Samson groups in that area in Polk County got together, and we had a really enjoyable couple of hours at Redeemer Church there.
Nice.
I got to hang with your friend of mine, Brian Seeley, who walked with us in England last year.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah. All right. Well, I feel like we're coming to the end of the banter time, Aaron. Maybe it's time to just gear up
the interview. Yeah, yeah.
Bring on the guests to lighten things up.
I feel bantered out. Let's just let's take a minute, and we'll come back here on the Pirate Monk Podcast.
We in the Samson Society love our meetings, and we love what happens between the meetings. In friendships, we know that recovery requires relationship, that the opposite of addiction is connection. And we've also learned that there are times when we've plateaued in our recovery, or if we've suffered a setback, when it really helps to make a connection outside the meetings with an expert coach or therapist. And we've featured a lot of those people on this podcast, including the Hunters, Roan and Roe and Eva Hunter of LifeWorks Counseling in Madison, Mississippi. The Hunters are thoroughly Christian and fully trained, certified sex addiction therapists. They and their staff work with individuals and with couples dealing with addiction and with betrayal trauma. And you don't have to live in Mississippi to see them. You can actually reach them at lifeworks.ms and connect with them through telehealth. And you may not need to commit to a long-term connection with them. Maybe what you need is to attend one of the several intensives that they run each year for the Samson Society. To reach the Hunters at LifeWorks, simply go to lifeworks.ms or give them a phone call at 601-790-0583. That number again, 601-790-0583. LifeWorks Counseling is a sponsor of the Pirate Monk Podcast. Welcome back to the Pirate Monk Podcast. Those of you who regularly subscribe to the show have heard me talk about Roy Smith in the last couple of episodes. He's the guy who, when I was up in Pennsylvania with Sam Black, Matt Wenger, gosh, I forget who, Troy Haas, just a few weeks ago. Roy was the man. We stayed at Roy's house. We recorded at his studio. And he's the man who talked me off the ledge when I had that crippling anxiety attack. Dr. Roy Smith, I should actually call you Dr. Roy Smith, because you have earned that PhD. Welcome, Roy. Thank you for joining the show.
It's great to be here. And you can call me Roy. I noticed in my work with people, especially when I ran a prison, the only people who called me Dr. Smith were the prisoners trying to make me like the title, so that they could then manipulate me as a result. So even in terms of, but you just say Roy, and that's what I answered.
I think that was really wise of you, Dr. Smith.
Got a diagnosis for Aaron already.
Oppositional defiance? Yes, I think that.
It didn't take him long.
Oh, darn.
So Roy, you now live and work not far from where you grew up in Pennsylvania. You're in Lebanon, Pennsylvania. I wonder if you'd maybe start out, we'd like our listeners to get to know our guests on a personal level. Give us a little bit of your story, how you grew up and how you wound up in the psychology.
I wound up in the psychology field simply for my own personal survival. I grew up in an evangelical minister's home, and everywhere my dad preached, within six for six, there were new church buildings to house the people. He would go from verse to verse, and that made great sense to me. But my dad never dealt with something that happened to him when he was 5 or 7 years old. And eventually, after years of faithful service, leading people to Christ, a wide variety of things, he self-destructs in an act of sexual infidelity with a woman who was a year and a half older than me, who was the choir director of the church. And then that ended his very positive career. My dad's trigger underneath it all was a deep sense of shame because his father, who he did not meet until he was about 8 years old, unless he visited him in the hospital, which was really a prison. My grandfather was shot 5 times holding up a store, a convenience store in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And thus he went to prison. And my dad was born while my grandfather was in prison. And about 5 years old, my dad's mom, for whatever ungodly reason, frankly, chose to tell him that she wanted to abort him but couldn't find anybody to do it. So he doesn't know his dad. His mom is an angry woman because of taking care of the children, etc. alone. Then his dad gets out of prison, immediately has another child who is the glory child, and my dad is kind of stuck out there wandering about. Finds God a little in his early 20s, and then I believe tries to serve God in such a fashion as to outrun what was put inside of him, instead of, as you guys practice constantly, figuring out what that trigger is and bringing it to God and getting it taken care of.
How old were you when his life went off the rails?
I was about 27 to 30 years old. I was a licensed psychologist at that time, and I could actually see it coming, but there was not much I could do about it. Now,
what did you see coming? Just burnout and disconnect?
Well, you know, we know we're about to fail when we think we're always right.
That's well put. Absolutely, yeah.
My dad was always right. He wasn't connected to other people on an accountability basis where he could express his lostness or his sickness in a way that people could be real in his life. Okay. And my mother, who has a diagnosis called a personality disorder called borderline personality disorder, he never dealt with her. In fact, he married a person exactly like his mother, who was angry and rageful. And that's why I became a therapist, because as the oldest of 3 other siblings, I was told by my mom that my destiny was that when she killed herself by driving off of a bridge into the nearby river, she was going to take me and my three younger siblings with her. Being spunky child, I thought maybe that wouldn't be a good idea for me, even though I could swim. And thus I decided to become her therapist, whereby if I could read her intuitively and work around her, I and my siblings would survive, and we did. So, but meanwhile, my dad never dealt with the fact that she had these problems. He ran into ministry to avoid it. In fact, towards the end of my existence with my dad, we had a very positive conversation that later on I can talk to you about if you want. But it was, but he never dealt with her hate of being a pastor's wife and her hate of him, I think, simply for being there.
Yeah. Wow. Wow.
So he derails when you're in your late 20s, you're already doing your clinical work. As a child, you know, you've got this looking up to dad, he's doing ministry on stages. Was there a point that, oh, I hold him in this high regard, or did you always feel those gaps of, I don't care that you're up there because you aren't that at home?
I believe that I drank the Kool-Aid for a while and went with the idealization that these people have very real needs that are coming to the door every day at the pastor's place, you know, and so at first I think I identify with it, and probably that identification drives me to at times do similarly self-destructive things by maybe making my clientele more important than my family.
Oh, yeah. So you wind up, you wind up, you've got a practice. Did you go in, immediately into private practice as a psychologist? How did you wind up? Right now you have, I think, at least 20 clinics across Pennsylvania. You got a massive practice with a lot of, you supervise a lot of people. Did you start out in private practice? How'd you wind up working? I'm very intrigued about what you did in prison. Tell us about that.
You've just asked about four questions to pull.
I know. But so, he's ADHD and he can
track each one of them. And Aaron, it doesn't bother me because I'm going to answer the question I want. So, if a guy gives you four, you can answer question five and he probably doesn't remember he asked it. So, you know, we can mess with him a little bit. Just don't give me up when I don't answer it. Okay. as a little boy, I was aware of the kid, of the person everybody said you stay away from them. They're the pervert. Okay.
Yeah.
That might touch boys. I grew up in a town, not much drug addiction back then, beginning of Vietnam, but a lot of alcoholism. And I wondered why my buddy Spencer, he lived in his grandparents' house and across the street were his parents' house. Why wouldn't you live with that? And so I was a very sensitive child because of my mom's fairly continuous verbal abuse with some physical abuse. Okay. And I attuned to people's pain. I saw pain. I could feel it. It was real to me. And I had empathy for it. And so I literally pictured myself as a therapist from about 8 to 10 years old. And then eventually it went to, you can help more people if you maximize what you're doing by teaching other people to be therapists too. And then it just kind of went like this. It started out in my living room. I would say to the clients, look at the mailbox. My neighbors thought I was narcissist of the year because it said Dr. Roy Smith. I'm a narcissist, but not of the year. And I said, look at that mailbox. because then I want you to walk up and I don't want you to ring the doorbell. No one's coming. I want you to walk right in the house. So I made sure they were walking in the right house, or that was going to really get me in trouble with my neighbors. And we did that for a couple of years while I worked another full-time job at Harrisburg State Hospital working with geriatric folks. And we worked the two together until finally God just kept blessing and blessing and blessing. And we're at where we're at today.
Yeah. So you've got this trajectory from a young age that's born out of a crucible of suffering, with both parents not meeting your needs as a child. So at what point, you know, you go out there and learn how to help other people, there's usually that point where many of us realize, oh crap, I need to deal with this broken thing inside of me. Was there a part, or did that just kind of come along with the whole thing?
That it came along. Very excellent question. And there was a specific time in my life that changed me. And it's probably something that a lot of the listeners can relate to be frank. Okay. And it is two different ways to relate to God. And so when I got done my bachelor's level education from the King's College in Briarcliff Manor, New York, I knew that I wanted to go to a psychology school that integrated the Bible. I wanted to go to Biola University in California, and I didn't feel emotionally ready. And so I decided to take 3 years in seminary. And so I went to seminary nearby where I'm at today. I actually got a Master of Divinity degree there. And I would work the second shift at a Christian psychiatric hospital. So I had during the day how right I am theologically, biblically. I mean, everything is a machine mechanized. I understand God down to the, you know, Nate knew how to do this. You could open up the Bible anywhere, point at it, and I could deliver a sermon, frankly, with not much meaning in my own life. And frankly, it scared me. And then I would go being right from 7 in the morning, where class started, Hebrew, that was a buster, till 3:30, I would be at the psych hospital. And I would be dealing with very real human beings and explaining to them these concrete, completely right stuff didn't always meet their deepest need. And it shocked me, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I'd go with my preconformed plan to make sure. See, if I listened to them, I would have had to listen to me. And that was offensive. Where if I stayed up into this world that I created that was mechanized, it was a defensive world. And everything could be controlled. Frankly, it was an angry world. It was a really angry world. Okay. Being always right. And so I would go, and God gave me about 3 or 4 older gentlemen who were Mennonite in orientation, who became doctors as a result of conscientious objectorhood. And then when they got done the war, they came out and started these Christian psych hospitals, and they had the patience of Job with this young whippersnapper who had everything figured out. And over a period of time, they gently showed me the God that relates to the deepest parts of who we are on an emotional and cognitive integrated level versus the God in my head, which I semi-created in order to control the universe and be a smaller God, which frankly I like better than the real God. And over a period of time, of a 3-year period, they took me into my pain, and I was able to let go of this false self that I built up with such pretense. And I was able to see who I was, and I began a journey where I've had over 40 years of individual work myself, and tons of seminars and various things, whereby I continue to look at those aspects of myself that aren't fully put together so I don't go back and recreate that ungodly, quote unquote, godly world.
Yeah. Let me ask a quick aside on that before we move on, because I know Nate has very specific things he wants to get to. But you just said, when I was in that space where everything was about what was right, I've got the truth nailed down, that was a very angry place. And I would love to hear your opinion on why the people that focus on right, biblical truth, I've interpreted my systematic theology in place, almost always have this undercurrent of anger. And I also see it when people talk about politics and other things where they're focused on a right, that it's such a consistent theme where if you're right, it seems like it should give you a whole lot of space to breathe and freedom, but it seems to constrict and choke. So why do you think that is?
That is a fantastic question. And if I don't answer it, please take me back to it, because then you said something else and it just really makes me, I find us humans funny. And I smile when we get in predicaments. You know, the one thing probably everybody here that's listening to this that may struggle with more than porn is perfectionism. Okay. Yeah. And so that self-righteous perfectionism, where what I call the human dilemma, whether no matter who we are, whether we believe in the God of the universe as stated in the Bible or not, the human dilemma exists. The things I want to do, I don't do. And the things I don't want to do, I do. Everybody I mentor, no matter what their faith system, knows that gap between the real them and the false them. And pornography covers it up. Different things cover up that gap as substitutes for actually dealing with it, feeling it. And so one of the things we throw into that gap is perfectionism. It's self-righteousness. And sadly, the worse we are, the more angrier we cling to an inadequate system that we know only temporarily deals with it. And how we deal with it is, if I am angry at you for what's going on within you, I can temporarily feel a false sense of power, and then that somehow causes me, in my Phariseeism, to be able to ignore my ultimate lostness. And Jesus confronted that. Jesus said, look, guys, you're lost. You know, you're lost and you're sick. Okay. And I don't go, and I think this is tongue in cheek, I don't go help the people that are found, and I don't help the people that are completely healthy. And when we understand that, and that's what these Samson groups are about, it is that we get together and we share our lostness, and we force ourselves to become comfortable with it, because if we don't, we will build the next Tower of Babel to hide from it, and that's when we come down, because we work our way up, and then boom, it falls over, and our life is destroyed.
Yeah. Wow.
Thank you.
Very well put, yeah. There's a phrase that we bumped into recently that I find very descriptive and helpful, and it's spiritual bypass. Right? Mm-hmm. I've got this uncomfortable fact of my life, this uncomfortable emotion, this thing I don't want to feel. Spirituality, this religion can offer me a way around it so that I don't have to deal with my pain. Spiritual bypass. And man, have I taken that bypass early in life. I mean, up till the age of 42, I took it a lot. And it still at times is a tempting detour.
But things have gotten better since you had your spiritual bypass surgery. You recovered.
You triple. Recovered. It was a triple
well.
Bypass.
Well, yeah, I didn't want to reveal all the details, but.
You know, it's very inconvenient. This little tiny verse in Romans 3:23, okay, for all have sinned. It is a very inconvenient verse when you think about it. And yet, so we develop all this stuff so we don't, so we can ignore those few lines.
Yeah.
Well, if we could shift gears a little bit, Roy, I know that, and this may, now that I hear your story, I wonder if it comes out of your own personal story. You really have a burden for father-son relationships and a good fatherhood. You've written a, by the way, Roy has a world-class video recording studio, film studio, sound studio that we recorded at up there in Lebanon called Live Up Studios. And one of the sets that's there is, or there are a couple of others, it's a freaking castle we're sitting in. That was created, I guess, for your 21st, Knights of the 21st Century, the making of a knight kind of a thing, right? Mm-hmm. And you've also authored a book called Inside Fatherhood. Mm-hmm. If you wouldn't mind, tell us a little bit about your passion for fatherhood and for what we can do better. We got a lot of fathers who listen to this show, and we get a lot of questions around how can I be a better dad? And I'm becoming more aware of the ways my father, my well-meaning, loving, devoted father failed me. I want to do better with my kids. How has that impacted your life and informed what you do today?
To me, it is central for we as men to deal with the historical precedents regarding what was given us from our own father legacy, okay, and be able to face that in a very real way, because there's pain associated with it. And if we don't look at these things, they will control us the rest of our lives without us understanding why. What we don't work through, we eventually express. And so whether it's prisons filled with people that don't have that kind of positive fatherhood legacy, you know, that, you know, I think sometimes men struggle, and what keeps them stuck is an odd thing. And that is males want to beat their own father in development while at the same time fearing it. And some guys have gotten stuck in the negative cycle regarding how they were treated is then how they treat the people that they're now responsible for to love. And it goes from sin from one generation to the next generation. And we have to give men permission to say, you know, my dad, as defined by, okay, are you guys ready for an interesting, controversial subject?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I'm ready. Oh, we love it. Okay.
Right. Here we go. All right. I'm not necessarily right, but we will talk about some real stuff. Mothers or fathers, we're going to do it both ways. Sit down, your listener, and spend a half hour writing out their definition of what a mother is. And then take another time after they seek God's being presence and write out for a half hour what you think a father is. And then you take some time, a third time, and you look at those and say, how much was my mother like how I would define a mother? And how much of a father was how I would define a father? These papers are my definition of fatherhood. And then compare it to what we had. And sometimes I have to say, my mother, from my consciousness on, never treated me as a mother should. I never had a mother, as I would define what a mother would be. She wanted to harm me. She hated me because I had the same name as my father, who she hated, and she would tell me free of charge how much I was like him. Okay. And so from the day she was born, literally to the day she died, and that's another story we don't have time for, she was attacking me and my siblings, and I was leading the defense. I didn't have a mother. I learned to love my mother by and forgive my mother through the doorway of saying she wasn't my mother. Because I had to face the reality and bring God into that tough reality that I didn't have a mom. And that's what allowed me then to bring who my mom was into that tough reality. The same way with my father. My father abandoned me for godly ministry, which then means it wasn't godly ministry, doesn't it? Yeah. And yet that is it. And so I had to say, and my dad and I talked about this at the end of life, hey, do you want me to tell you how you've hurt me? Okay? Mm. Because we have to deal with reality. And a lot of times we spend, God can't help you and I pretend better. He can't help pretend that we have a mom and dad and pretend better. God can help us when we quit pretending, accept what we've got. So about 10 to 15 years ago, I'm driving into Lancaster, Pennsylvania to visit one of my clinics. And during that stage of my life for 30 years, this is what I did. And I was praying to God about 5 minutes from where I was going to land. And I was praying to God and thanking God after years of therapy for my abusive mother. And I meant it. I thought, this is crazy. But I actually was crying and thanking God for my abusive mother. And then I prayed to God on my way to be at my clinic. I prayed God and thank you for my abusive father, my abandoning father, who taught me the Bible, thank God. But other than that, okay, really wasn't present for most important areas of my life. And at one point was so strict, I couldn't fish on Sundays, couldn't buy anything on Sundays. I mean, it was legalism on steroids.
That gratitude, what was it anchored to? Was it a list of, I'm seeing specific things, and that is bringing a sense of gratitude? Or was it a feeling that was more general, that you were feeling God's goodness through that? I don't know. Tell me about what anchored
Let me. I'll finish the story here because I'm heading that way. But it is coming to terms with the reality of my life, and then seeing this next step. Mm-hmm. Next step is, what did I become because I made it through all this bad crap?
Yeah.
What did I become? And God said to me, Boy, you are about to walk into a clinic. These therapists are scared of their clients. They're angry at their clients. They have no idea how to help their clients. They're going to give you the worst cases in the next hour and a half and they're worried about these people. They want to help them, but it's not, these are hard to figure out. And Roy, you know that hour and a half for you is going to be like 30 to 40 seconds. And for every case, you're going to have more ideas to help them than you can literally get out of your mouth. Your mind is going to be going so fast. And you're not scared because you face that abuse. You're not scared about the craziness, saying a family's crazy the way it's actually crazy. You're not as scared of reality because you bought that reality to me. And you and I have worked through that reality. And now you have strengths to face from here on out whatever reality is out there, because you did your homework and went with other people, different relationship support, into what you needed to deal with. And you can do lead clinics the way you lead clinics, because without your mom, you would have never been able to accomplish it. The work you did after you owned you didn't have one. Without your dad, in the ways you didn't have a dad, but the work you did, that gives you strength beyond belief. You don't have to live frightened. You can face with what is. And there's a power in that. Everybody listening to this, if they keep doing those groups and talking, will get, and they can come to terms with it. And the work be over. And it's not just over. Strength can replace it.
I'm just feeling my time sitting on my bed with my mom making up a song for the verse, "In everything give thanks, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus concerning you." We talk a lot about gratitude and how important it is. But I think, and you correct me if I'm wrong, you just described a long journey of learning the difference between "in everything give thanks" and "for everything give thanks," and that the "in everything" comes at various stages way down the road from the hurt and the wounds and the trauma.
And you trust God enough, the God, I don't want to cry here, but these guys trust God, the God of the universe, enough that they don't pretend to be what isn't, and they don't refill in the story the way they wanted the story to be, and they bring that reality to God, and God is not intimidated by that reality, and God will love them through it.
Yeah.
This beautiful moment on the way to your clinic. It's a special day.
It was a very special day. Never forgot it. I went, and then, you know, you keep double checking. Am I being nuts doing this? And I go, no, it's real. This is who I am. And I go in there and people give me tough cases and I'm having fun. And I go, thank you, crazy mom. Without you, I'd have never learned how to do it. I wouldn't sign up for another round.
Yeah. Brian, I know you carry a real concern for people in ministry.
Yeah.
And that's behind a ministry that you put together called Servants Oasis, and behind a project that you introduced me to while I was there. You took me out and showed me a project in process called Servants Garden, which is just impossible for me to put words to. Is some of that, do you think? I'd love for you to talk about Servants Oasis and Servants Garden. I'm wondering, is that now that I hear about, you know, that tragic story of your father with his unmet needs and just working himself to death in ministry, trying to outrun his pain, I wonder if that was, would you have ever started Servants Oasis and done Servants Garden if you hadn't had that dad?
No. I needed that. I needed that dad. I needed that rejection. I needed that whole journey on both their parts. And together, it was fire. I mean, I would go to bed at night with a pillow over my head as a little boy while they had their Christian discussions that I had memorized. Yeah. And I didn't think it was a Christian discussion, to be frank. Okay. Yeah. And, yeah. And sold this reality on Sunday as they walked out and took everybody's hand. And then that night, you know, the explosion and the game would begin. So to me, there is a real desire, and you guys know this, the more we work with Jesus, the further from Jesus we know we are. And yet there's a desire to just take our faith and make it more and more real. Because we see the cost of the fakeness of it all. One thing back on the fatherhood book, if I can put in a shameless plug, is the one positive memory I have of my father. There's several times when God used him in amazing ways. But I look back, and when he was, it felt like gold to me, maybe five times a year, he would say, "Can I read to you tonight?" And he would read Pilgrim's Progress, or he would read the slang of Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn.
Yeah.
And I remember those moments, and I didn't want to fall asleep because it felt real, it felt compassionate, I felt presence. So part of Live Up Resources is that I wrote a book for my grandkids, not thinking I could survive some heart issues that were coming my direction. And I thought, if I'm not here, God, what do I want my grandchild to know? Grandson at the time. There's since been a second grandson. And I go, I want him to know every male, he's a leader. So the direction is, are you leading him this way or this way? We're all influencers. We were designed to be heroes. I wanted to teach him that a man has emotions and how to develop his emotional IQ, to teach social skills. You know, some guys say, you know, no one loves me. And I want to say to them, well, how are you doing on trying to become a little more lovable? So when they're trying to do what God commands, it's not so difficult. You know,
you know, wife's saying, I'm trying to follow Jesus, but why does it have to be so hard? You know, and so I wrote a series called The Campfire Gang, where a father can read to a daughter, 25% of the kids that listen to it are girls. And it's about eight boys working their way through back home because they didn't listen. And I want to teach them the Bible is real. So they run into a rock, it groans and vibrates with a real weird voice. It's always a Bible verse. They learn to stand on the rock when they're in trouble. They meet God. They meet Jesus. They meet the Holy Spirit. But it deals with very real issues that young kids struggle with in a way that they start to see that God is very approachable and present. And you want to, as a father, create those memories where you stop being this up here, down here kind of thing, and you just sit there and you play together in a way that they can feel God and Jesus through you. And that, I recommend guys check out The Campfire Gang.
Yeah. Okay.
Nice. Well, tell me a little more, because, you know, Nate couldn't put words to it, which is inconvenient on a podcast, about the Oasis.
Yeah. Well, let me just say this. Aaron, you and I have been to formal gardens in England. We've been to a Blenheim Palace. Oh. We know what a formal garden looks like. Roy has taken me to a neglected, but he is rehabilitating, an honest-to-God formal garden in the middle of frickin' Pennsylvania that that is being designed as now as a contemplative, more than a contemplative place, a guided contemplation to help a man or a woman take a look at their life. That's a terrible description, but I tried.
It's called the Agape Gardens. And God, we have a missionary ministry retreat center because we believe 80% of the kingdom of God work is done by 20% of the people and they're exhausted. And so we want to create equipping for pastors, missionaries, seminars for couples, wide variety of issues out of the retreat center. And then we have the Agape Gardens, which everybody in their own personal growth, the strength of their personal growth is based on the relationship with God. And the relationship with God is based on the ability to slow yourself down, look up, and open up in a way that God can deal with it. So I buy this, the board leads us to buy this property. Now, God has a wicked sense of humor because I look at a garden and I think it's work. Okay. Weeding. I don't necessarily love the beauty of gardens. And I remember going out with God and I open up this rat infested chair that half was worried if I'd hold me up. It's got so many tears in it from rats and mice. And I sit out there and say, God, why'd you give me a garden? Mm-hmm. And then here's what he said. He said, here's what I want you to do. And we have 12 different areas of that garden whereby a person prayers. You begin with the cross and you end with the tomb. And the idea is that God created humanity to walk in a garden. Humanity changed with sin. The garden sure became thorny and tougher. But God's initial desire is never changed. And each of these guys listening to this are walk every day. God put them in a special garden. And he wants to walk with them wherever they're at, thorns and all. And so we thought, let's create this garden and take them through a series of types of prayers and ways of evaluating yourself, etc., so that you can then strengthen your walk in the individual garden God created. And it was such an honor to take Nate and show them the Agape Gardens, as well as the areas that we're trying to raise money and renovate for pastors and missionaries so that we can do these equipping seminars.
So it sounds like you've made an Edenic labyrinth.
Yeah, it's not quite a labyrinth, but yeah, but, more like the Stations of the Cross. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It begins. Now, our cross is interesting, Aaron, if we can do it. We're in the midst of, we're going to dedicate. This cross, when you walk up to it, okay, is going to have thousands and thousands of nails, as many nails as we can have. So the flatter, any area you can see other than what's in the ground, we want nails sticking out. Because a lot of these listeners to this, they believe Jesus died for every sin but their list. And we want you, when you walk up the cross, to see so many nails. And then there's going to be a little sign, and that little sign's going to say, "Did he die for your sin?" And being a simplistic man, the other sign says, "You bet."
Yeah.
Anything that anybody listening to this has ever done, there's a nail on that cross that says, "If you let me," Jesus is saying, "I'll take care of it. If you let me, I will take care of it."
I want to know about your heart with this as you get to enter into helping heal and serve burnt out and broken ministers in the most appropriate way possible. You get the opportunity to save your dad over and over. What does that do to your heart?
That's an excellent question. Okay. I think that I had to come to terms with my own inability not to change anybody. And frankly, I wasn't really that good at changing me either. Okay. Mm-hmm. Let alone changing you. All right. And I think over a period of time, the story of Servants Oasis is a book in and of itself. 12 years of legal struggle. It was going to be built on my property, where 3 months from starting to build it on my property, a better property is found where we can do better and it's cheaper. Okay. My neighbors up in arms because they're afraid that a minister or missionary will walk off the property and somehow harm them. I mean, it was, we won in the highest state of Pennsylvania after several legal losses. It's been a heartbreak for me. But I think during that journey, it's moved from a compulsive need to save my parents, which I've come to terms with, to let us show you another way if you're in ministry, and if it helps you, fine. And if it doesn't, it's up to you.
Shifted from saving your dad to serving those,
yes,
like your dad.
Yes. Yes, just serving, and whatever they do, they do. You know, I mean, there's guys listening to this that have really been excellent spiritual directors and sponsors to people. Okay. And they end up just like God ends up often, whereby that person utilizes all that care and concern and love in a way that's dishonest and takes off and completely destroys themselves despite that effort. And that's just the nature of who we humans are. And we can, and what allows me to join up and help people is I don't believe I can fix them. And when I know and accept I can't fix them, I can now help them.
Wow.
Nice. Well, Roy, how do people get in touch with the stuff you're doing? Like get their books, get the Campfire Kids. Okay, what was that called again? The Campfire Cadets, the cadre of campfires. Campfire Gang. I knew it was something like that. So where do people go to get these books to find out more about the Oasis and all the stuff you're doing?
Well, it would be liveupresources.com. liveupresources.com, and it would be servantsoasis.com, servantsoasis.org. And servantsoasis.org, they can see our plan. Our goal should God bless us, is to develop a prototype so that we can create these retreat centers across the country so that within a 15-hour drive, we can be available to assist any denomination or person that believes the Bible's true, etc., assist them in their faith walk.
Awesome. Well, I think, Nate, we should just wrap the whole thing up here. So listeners, remember, you can send us your thoughts, your notes, your questions, things that we should have said and didn't, or did say and shouldn't have. Send that to piratemonkpodcast@gmail.com and address it to Nate Larkin.
Well, what a great conversation. So good to see your face and hear your voice again, Roy. I'm so grateful that God saw fit after all these years to have our paths cross. That's it for this week's episode of the Pirate Monk Podcast. We have a way of signing off, Roy, where we say our names. So until next week, you're in on this, Roy. I'm Nate.
I'm Roy.
And I'm Consuela. I don't know.
We are your
pals. Yeah. Damn.
We are your pals on the Pirate Monk Podcast.
The Pirate Monk Podcast is produced by members of the Samson Society. Send your feedback or questions to piratemonkpodcast@gmail.com. Please give us a 5-star review on iTunes and share the podcast with a friend. For more information, please visit samsonsociety.com.